Where do I start? How do I train recall? How long should we work on healing before moving on? Is crate training really that important? We hear these questions all the time, and there's one answer that will help with all of them. The complete step-by-step dog training course found at Standing Stone Supply. They break down the what, when, where, and how to train your own dog from 8 weeks to 1 year old. They've got it all laid out for you, down to even the daily activity checklist to keep you and your puppy on track. Check out standingstonesupply.com and remember to use code GDIY to save 10%. Being an upland hunter in the South nowadays unfortunately means a lot of travel to try and find birds for my dogs. This means it's even more important that my map scouting is reliable to justify the effort. This is where Onyx comes in. I can honestly say that Onyx directly impacts the level of success I find on my trips. Whether it's the private versus public land boundaries, the expanding number of unique layers and features by state, or the 3D mapping capabilities, my initial step in planning my hunting trip starts with Onyx. To know where you're going, you have to first know where you stand. Check out Onyx Hunt Maps and use code GDIY20 at checkout to save 20%. All right, everybody, welcome back to part two of this RGS series. My guest, as always throughout this series, is Nick B. Miller. Nick, welcome back.
Yeah, hey, Nick, good to be with you again.
Yeah, so I don't know about you, but I got a pretty good response from the intro to the series that we're doing that we put out last month. I got a pretty good response from a lot of people. I don't know what kind of feedback you got from everybody, but there's a lot of excited people on my end.
Yeah, no, I'd say the same thing. I mean, both just from colleagues and members and friends and family too, Nick. I mean, I think folks seemed really excited about it and seemed like it got kind of picked up and listened to by a lot of different folks. And I think it went well, and it was so fun. Let's do it again.
But, yeah.
No, I really appreciate you kind of having us on again to move forward with all this. And I think it's a lot of fun and really great.
Yeah. You know, we have a nice list of topics and discussions that we're going to be coming down the pipe with this series. But, you know, I thought something that me and you were on the same page with that we both thought was important was to go ahead and start off on the right foot with definitions of common terms, the players in the game, everything that kind of encompasses what we're going to be talking about over the next few months in this series. We wanted to give just a quick kind of synopsis of those terms and what they actually mean, so people don't have to like stop and go look them up to follow along what we're doing.
That sounds great, Nick. And I think as someone who's a forester and kind of a silviculture nerd, I think that, you know, we as kind of sciencey conservation people sometimes struggle with kind of describing some of our work to kind of non-technical audiences.
Yes.
And so I'll do the best I can to kind of think about some of these definitions and terms, just thinking about, you know, maybe general member of the public or listener on the call, but also help kind of rein me in and seek additional clarification needed, man.
Absolutely. So, I mean, we know that this one isn't really the sexiest of topics like we're going to get to, but it is important nonetheless. And that's kind of what my job is to kind of keep you grounded so you don't get up into the technical cloud, so to speak, with everybody, right? So,
right. Sounds good.
Is there really anywhere else to start other than the players in the game, all the NGOs and government agencies? Is there really anywhere else to start besides that?
No, that sounds good to me.
So go ahead and give us a breakdown. Like, who are we dealing with, all the players in the game and the different types of land and everything that we're going to be discussing?
Yeah, sure. That sounds good. So I guess, like, you know, broadly speaking, in terms of, you know, this translates both from the different types of forest land ownerships that we work with on habitat and forestry projects, but also the types of kind of partners that we just work with on different types of our different types of projects, different types of our efforts. You know, it's kind of private, state, and federal, right? And private, you could kind of break into, you know, NGOs or nonprofit organizations or non-governmental organizations, or you could break into kind of private industry and private companies. And so kind of in the NGO nonprofit space, we work really with a lot of different groups in a lot of different ways. And, you know, part of that kind of focus of our new model of working forests is really kind of building out and taking to the next level some of the existing partnerships that we had with other conservation organizations over the years, but also build new partnerships, identify new kind of strategic opportunities to work together with like-minded groups to really be able to do more together than any of our organizations could kind of on their own. And so, you know, right now here in the Southern Appalachians, we've got really strong relationships and partnerships with a lot of other conservation organizations, including kind of the more, you know, very similar kind of game species conservation orgs, like the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, like Quail Forever and Pheasant Forever, like National Wild Turkey Federation, but also just kind of more broadly forest conservation organizations and wildlife conservation organizations, such as the Appalachian Mountains Joint Venture, the American Bird Conservancy, Audubon in some states, the Nature Conservancy, and other more kind of local or state level groups too, like the Tennessee Wildlife Federation is a, you know, really strong partner of ours in Tennessee as well. I guess the last on kind of the NGO nonprofit side would be, you know, universities. Many universities are structured as nonprofits, and primarily when it comes to kind of disseminating information or working together on different kind of wildlife monitoring, we work really closely with a lot of the land grant universities and smaller, you know, colleges and universities as well.
Well, real quick before we move on to the government agencies on this, I actually got a listener question from the last one. I wasn't really planning on bringing it up on this one, but it's going right into the topic. Is he was curious, how much interaction do the NGOs have between each other? Like, is there, it, I guess really how he was asking the question was, why is there a need to have so many different specialty groups and organizations? Why can't everybody just get on the same page and like do the bigger goals? So like he was wondering, how much communication and discussion do you guys have between NGOs to actually put habitat?
Yeah, no, that's a really great question, Nick. Thanks for asking it. And I think something that we talk about a lot in conservation is really the need to kind of break down the silos between our different organizations and really just work more effectively together. And so I'll give you some examples of that. So we right now in Tennessee and Kentucky are managing a pretty big multi-year, multi-partner, multi-state forest restoration and habitat restoration project. So it's funded through the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, which is a private foundation that administers both federal and private funds. So they're funding Rough Grouse Society, but we're working with like 10 to 15 different organizations and agencies on that project, including some of those ones I just mentioned, and all the state agencies and federal partners as well. And we are kind of through that grant and that funding source, administering other funding to other partners through subawards to help support some of their staff and some of their efforts to be involved in the project to help, you know, move things forward in a really collaborative, effective way. And so I just hosted our quarterly call for that group this morning, which had, you know, a lot of these entities I just mentioned, TNC, the Appalachian Mountains Joint Venture, the state agencies, the U.S. Forest Service, we're all on that call, and we're having quarterly calls to really check in about project activities, about progress, about timelines, about budgets, to really work effectively together as a group. And so we've got a few other iterations of those, of these kind of multi-partner, multi-state, multi-year projects that kind of gel everything together. But I guess I'll say kind of beyond just kind of individual funded projects, you're totally right. Like there's a need for all of our organizations and all of our agencies to really, you know, be true to our own missions, but really recognize that our missions often really overlap a lot.
Yeah.
And that sometimes kind of the silos that we put ourselves in, or the camps we put ourselves in, can actually be really counterproductive just to be able to get the habitat on the ground and get more work moving forward. So we're actively trying to break down those silos and work with a lot of different folks. And I'll tell you this, that can be as kind of informal as just kind of handshake agreements of working together or working through these funded projects, or with a lot of our partners, we have actual formal MOUs, memorandums of understanding, that kind of lay out how we work together. We have quarterly calls with them to check in about progress. An example of that, Nick, is with the Congressional Sportsmen's Foundation. So we have a national kind of overarching MOU with CSF, with Congressional Sportsmen's Foundation, to collaborate with them on policy work and on some advocacy work and some communication work. And, you know, we're checking in regularly with them about progress on that and how we can better realize that MOU to serve each other's kind of mutual interests.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And man, I had like 500 questions come up into my brain during all that, but we're going to move on because I know that, I mean, the topics that we have coming down the map, like all this is going to come back up and we're going to be able to kind of discuss this in more detail and more thoroughly. But I want to make sure that we stay on track with this episode. So, you know, go ahead. You mentioned a number of those government agencies just then.
Yeah.
The Forest Service, you know, kind of expand on that. Talk about the big players and who we need to mention in this so everybody's kind of familiar with who outside of NGOs we're dealing with on a regular basis.
Yep. Yeah, that sounds great, Nick. So, so on the state level, you know, we're primarily working with state wildlife agencies and state forestry agencies, right? So every state has a forestry agency and a wildlife agency. In Tennessee, it's the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency and the Tennessee Division of Forestry. And so those agencies both have their own state level wildlife action plans and their own state level forest action plans. And one of our primary roles as a conservation partner is to help those agencies implement the objectives from their state level action plans. So that's one of our big goals with them. On the federal side, at least here in the Southern Appalachians, we're primarily working with the U.S. Forest Service and also the Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS. And so those are the two major USDA federal agencies that kind of work in our region. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't really have any land in the Southern Appalachians. So we coordinate with them on a couple projects. But when it comes to actual habitat work, we have a pretty large national forest ownership here in the Southern Appalachians, right? And these are multiple use forests that are managed for diverse goods and services, including, you know, wildlife habitat and forest health. And so that's kind of where we're working with them largely, is to help them with their capacity to get more work done on their national forest lands that they own and manage. NRCS is interesting because they are a private lands focused federal agency. So their role is to provide technical and financial assistance to both agricultural producers and forest products producers. So forest landowners, private forest landowners.
Yeah. I've actually used them myself here on my private property with EQIP funding and habitat management. So for private lands, like that's probably the first place to go check if you have private lands. And then, you know, obviously talk to the biologists and stuff and get a plan going. But I'm familiar with them. I like them so far.
Nice. Glad you've had a good experience. Yeah. And then just, Nick, the last thing I'll mention kind of on different players is, you know, kind of the private, more private industrial side of things. And so we've got kind of forest industry, be it kind of, you know, saw timber, sawmills or pulpwood mills that we work with kind of on the supply chain side and on project development and implementation of different habitat work. And then we also have a decent amount of actual industrial ownership in the Southern Appalachians, primarily in kind of eastern Kentucky and some in southwest Virginia. So these are kind of timberland investment organizations that manage land as a financial investment, but also there's some potential for partnering with them to help focus some of their management kind of on habitat projects in the right places too.
Well, let's move on into some of the other like types of funding agreements, arrangements to really kind of get some projects up and going, you know, your grants, your stewardship agreements, stuff like that. You know, kind of give us a quick checkbox, and you can keep this one light because we are going to have an entire episode on grants and stewardships.
Just keeping it kind of light, part of what we do kind of under the umbrella of the new model as forest conservation directors is we're kind of the network architects of our regions, right? And so for me, it's the Southern Appalachian region, the mountain regions of six states down here. And part of what I do kind of on the project development, business development side is I pursue different partnerships and funding sources to support our program and to hire more foresters to go create more habitat. And so that includes kind of state and federal grants. It includes utilizing chapter funds on different projects. It includes using timber sale receipts from things like our stewardship projects. It includes kind of, you know, forestry and wildlife agreements through NRCS, allocated through Farm Bill funding. Other kind of direct innovative agreements, and also things like private foundation funding. And so, you know, generally we kind of put those things into the realm of kind of grants and agreements when it comes to some of our funding. And so grants are usually things that we apply for on a competitive basis, either federal grants or private grants, usually from foundations. And so we'll work on proposals with other partners to apply for funding, support some of our programming and some of our habitat projects. But then we'll also enter into agreements which are really less restrictive, aren't usually part of a competitive proposal process, and are really direct kind of funding opportunities negotiated between us and a funding partner, really where there's kind of a mutual interest and mutual benefit of kind of working together.
So I know that's a big, heavy topic. You know, everybody there, anybody listening that's not technical, like you just said, I guarantee they have more questions now than answers. And don't worry, we are going to be talking about this in more detail and kind of explain how that kind of interacts and what it looks like at the end result, as well as some of the questions that other people have on do you really need to have stewardship agreements, right? You know, we're going to cover it from both angles on that, but I think it's important to, before we start wrapping this up, is talk about some of the terminology that we actually use for the habitat cuts, right? You know, the shelter wood, I think, is one that you kind of clued me into recently. Is there anything like that that would help somebody just listening to this maybe for the first time kind of track a little bit more with what kind of habitat work that we're trying to get on the ground?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so the number one thing that we're trying to do is really to increase the proportions of young and open forest on the landscape, right? Primarily for rough grouse, it's really that young forest condition that's lacking at large scales, large landscape scales. And so, you know, we know that cutting trees creates young forest habitat. From kind of a forestry or silviculture perspective, you know, there can be a difference on kind of how you get there. And so, you know, I'm a forester. I'm also a silviculture nerd. So this stuff kind of excites me. But, you know, there's basically like two primary ways to create young forests. There's kind of the clear cut method and then the shelterwood method as being the two primary, what we call kind of even aged regeneration treatments. And so a clear cut is a legitimate silvicultural practice where, you know, you do a full harvest where you remove all stems, primarily with the goal of establishing kind of a new age class of trees that develop post-harvest. Shelterwood is similar, but is usually a series of partial cuttings that then get you to that phase of establishing that new age class of trees. And is really one of the kind of best courses of actions we have for oak management, for managing oak trees. And so I'll just give you kind of two examples of what different forms of a shelter wood treatment look like. But it's always kind of a multi-stage process of some sort. There's one example would be like the shelter wood burn technique, where you might go into a stand. You might not have as much oak on the site to begin with in the sub canopy that you want to have in that stand in the future. So you might cut 50% of the stand with your first entry. You might run fire through that stand several times until you help get oak trees established, oak seedlings established. And then you might come back in about 5 years after you run some fire through it, when you have a nice carpet of oak regeneration in the understory, and you might then remove that entire overstory to really release release that oak that's established and create that young forest habitat. And so, you know, when we think about creating kind of young forest for rough grouse, it's also an opportunity to create young forest, but also to create high quality young forest that manages for the crop trees and the mass producing trees that we want to regenerate, both for wildlife, but also for timber production.
Right. Man, yeah, and once again, I'm ignoring a bunch of questions to stay on topic on this time, but I know that we're going to cover each one of these things in detail, so I'm excited to get to it. But is there anything else that you think we'd be remiss to not kind of call out and define for somebody to kind of just help them along through this series?
Yeah, that's a good question, Nick. I mean, I think the other big one is just, you know, stewardship. And so there's a lot of different ways that that word is used. Shared stewardship is like a broad federal USDA strategy, basically for working across boundaries and agencies and organizations to get more work done. Stewardship authority is actually kind of a authority that the U.S. Forest Service has that was authorized to them in the 2014 Farm Bill. And that gives them the ability to enter into stewardship contracts or stewardship agreements with organizations like RGS. And then there's like stewardship agreements, which is really kind of this unique agreement between the Forest Service and a third party conservation partner such as RGS, based on kind of that mutual interest and mutual benefit of working together to get more work done. And so we can dive more into that when we kind of get into stewardship explicitly. But I think there's probably, you know, it's some of this stuff is always complicated when you're working with the federal government.
Yep.
And there's a lot of different ways that that term is kind of used. So,
well, and that perfectly leads into the next episode that'll be coming out next month, to where we're going to discuss everything, the pros, cons, the differences between state versus federal versus private lands, because each one kind of is a different can of worms for you and the uphill battle, it seems like, in some cases on getting the habitat on the ground so that these birds have a fighting chance down here. Nick, I appreciate you taking the time out of your day, sharing this stuff. I know this wasn't the sexiest of topics, but I think we needed to cover it. And I'm excited to really kind of hit on each one of these different topics and really start getting into some of this fun information.
Absolutely, Nick. Yeah, I hope that wasn't too technical, or that I stayed focused on just definitions. I might have veered a little bit down some rabbit holes, but no, I appreciate it too. I hope this helps set the stage.
Absolutely. And listeners, you know, if we didn't cover something on this one, be sure to listen for the next round, like the actual topics when we break this all down. Hopefully it makes more sense. But if you have any questions, comments, be sure to shoot them to me, gundogityourself@gmail.com. And Nick, until next time, I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Nick. Appreciate you.
Thanks for listening to GDIY. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to take a moment to subscribe, rate, review, and share with a friend. Also, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at GundogItYourself. If you really enjoy this podcast and would like to contribute even more to future content, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/GundogItYourself. Thanks again, and happy hunting. Everyone seems to have the same questions or concerns when they start trying to decide which kennel to purchase for their vehicle. Perhaps it's time to stop asking all the questions and just design the perfect setup that meets your exact needs. B-Pro Kennel specializes in designing and fabricating custom premier dog boxes handcrafted right here in the USA from high-grade, lightweight aluminum. They'll get you set up with the size dimensions, lighting, storage, battery boxes with solar charging, and anything else you can dream of. Stop stressing over buying the wrong setup just after replace it again in a year. Go ahead and check out bprokennels.com and get exactly what you want.
If you're considering changing your dog's food soon, then be sure to check out Eukanuba Pro Performance. Their science-backed formulas are designed to take your dog to the next level of performance. They also now have the new puppy formula to help your pup start strong and live active. When looking at all the different food options, remember Eukanuba to help power their ultimate performance.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? It's Bob from Lone Duck's Gun Dog Chronicles podcast. I hope you just enjoyed the episode you just listened to. And if you did, I think you'll enjoy hopping on ours. We've got professional retriever trainers and upland bird dog trainers from across the country and world sharing their tips and tricks and great stories to help you and your dog get ready for the season. We'll see you there.